Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everybody. It's a Blizzard Watch podcast. I'm your host, Matt Rossi. With me this week is my fantastic co-host, Joe Perez. Joe, we talked about it a little bit on the pre-show, but what the heck. What are you up to right now?
Just getting ready to start a brand new season for the Blood Bowl League that I'm running. Doing a lot of minis, painting a lot of minis, printing a lot of minis, and just organizing and herding cats. And it is my birthday week, so I'm getting ready to spend some time with friends and family and enjoy the fact that I'm getting old.
Yeah. You're getting old.
I said getting. Didn't say
must
that I was.
Suck to be as old as you, Joe. Yeah, terrible, terrible. Anyway, been a lot of stuff going on in the Blizzard world this week, so we'll move right on into those top stories, and I'm going to do this without going into a southern accent for once because I have no reason to do so, and I'm sorry I ever do it. First up, this is one I'm going to mention because it's kind of near and dear to my heart. We finally know something about Diablo Immortal. It's not a release date, because of course it's not a release date. Why would Blizzard give us a release date? But we do know that, and I'm putting quotes, air quotes here really hard, regional testing is going to roll out this summer.
Makes sense.
I don't know what they mean by regional testing. I don't know if they mean we're going to test this in China. I don't know if they mean we're going to test this in specific regions. I have no idea. I just know that that's what they said.
That's what regional testing is. So regional testing is something where you take a specific set of software, and it's like a stress test, but you do it in particular with like mobile, with certain regional networks. So like they'll do sections here in the States, they'll probably do sections in Europe, and they'll probably do sections in China for sure, to try to see how the systems can handle that network traffic, because at the end of the day, it is a connected game. And you have to test to see how those individual service areas affect that type of gameplay. So they want to see how that interacts. So you'll see it here, but you'll see it like it might be specific to a single carrier, like Verizon or something like that might be the one here that gets it. It might be, you know, Hanwei and in China. And then they'll start gathering data that way. So when they say regional, that's what they mean.
So that's all we know right now. They haven't said, you know, exactly when they're going to do it, and they haven't said what it means for when this game will actually come out, but we at least know now that this was an earnings call, by the way. They were doing the most recent earnings call when they made this announcement. So yeah, that's something. Diablo Immortal is actually going to come out at some point. I've been wanting them to bring this thing out for a while, because like I've said before, it's a Diablo MMO on phones and iPads and stuff. So yeah, that's pretty insane. I'm looking forward to it. I don't know that I'll play it, because I don't play a lot of phone games because I can't see very well. But I am interested in seeing what it brings out in terms of lore for the setting and what effect it has if any, on the development of Diablo 4, which we should move on to the next story we got. Rod Ferguson, who was a big deal over at the Coalition, the guys who did Gears of War, and specifically very important at Gears 5, has moved over to Blizzard to basically run Diablo. He is now in charge of the Diablo IP. That's his job. He's the Diablo guy. That's amazing to me. I don't play Gears of War. It's not my game. There were other games I liked at the time Gears came out. I never got into it. But Gears 5, a lot of people talked about how it basically the campaign was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And specifically that it was very much an open world, almost RPG-like experience, very similar to how other games have come out and done that kind of experience lately. I think the two big ones from Sony were Horizon Zero Dawn and God of War. I would say that Titanfall 2 very much did that kind of story.
Yes.
Although it was more of a... I think Titanfall 2 is more similar to Gears of 5 here than those previous games I mentioned. Titanfall 2 is another game with a really good campaign, but still very much based in being a shooter. It kept the essence of the game that came out before it while expanding it with a more robust story. And I have to feel like that's why they're hiring Ferguson.
I think so, too.
Yeah, he's proved that he can do this. He can take... a game that is basically, hi, I have an extremely large neck and a gun with a chainsaw on it, and he can get a story out of it.
Well, and I think it's a little bit beyond that, though, too. He has a very good idea of preservation when it comes to these things, too, because that's something that I think people... I've seen people talk about this, and they seem to miss this. When he's taken over any project he's worked on, he preserves or tries to preserve as much as possible the things people like about that setting, that game, that world. And it's not just go in and blow things up and pick a new direction. It's go in, what can we do to keep it move fresh, but keep that feel, keep it feeling the same. And that's why I think this is really, really good, because we saw some weird stuff with Diablo 3 where they tried to do new things and didn't really have a pulse on a finger on the pulse of what was players wanted, or at least it seemed at the beginning. Now you have somebody walking in who's understands how to look at a player base. This is what they like. This is what is good about this game. Here's what people love about, like in this case, Diablo. And here's how we can make it more. Here's how we can take this and go different places with it, but still keep everybody along for the journey. And I think that's kind of important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that's why we're seeing this move. I do think this move means that we are much further away from Diablo 4 than we might think.
I agree.
You do not bring somebody in like this when the game is done or even half done. This is okay, we've got our conceptual blocks hammered down. We have the gameplay hammered down. Now, how do we make this the game we want it to be? And that's when you bring in that guy. I played the demo for Diablo 4, and I know the gameplay is there. The three classes they had, the gameplay is absolutely there already. So, yeah, I see this as a positive move overall. And I think, Joe, I think you're pretty much on board with that too, right?
I agree. I actually think this has got me a lot more excited. I was already excited for Diablo 4, but this has got me more excited to see what they produce from it. Because with somebody like this at the helm, I think it's going to have some pretty cool stuff coming for us, I think.
Yeah, and also the fact that Ferguson's got so much experience with both Microsoft and networks in general means that when Blizzard inevitably puts this game on consoles, he has an understanding of how that works. Because Gears 5 was a huge console title.
Oh yeah, big, massive.
And he has an understanding of how Microsoft's networks work, how those consoles work. So, yeah, absolutely. Next thing we're going to talk about really fast. Because there's not a lot to talk about, but the Shadowlands prequel novel has had a little teaser released, a couple of pages preview. What did you think of it, Joe?
I am intrigued. I try not to go too far into it just because I want to read the whole thing. Excerpts are great, but they just get me salivating for more. It's some interesting direction, and some of the... We kind of knew one of the things was going to be a topic, and I don't want to ruin anything for anybody, and I want to skirt around it, but we talked about it on Lore Watch about one of Sylvanas's possible goals. And the novel and the excerpt confirms one of those goals. Like, yeah, this is going to be an interesting Shadowlands. And if this is going to set it up anything like Before the Storm set up BFA, I cannot wait to read the entirety of this novel.
I was just interested to see that they've hit on something that I've been thinking about but didn't know how to put into words, which was that the Zandalari don't have anything to be particularly happy about here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the end of the war, the Zandalari are the only ones who took a hit from the Alliance.
Yeah, they're it was the their capital city that got hit.
Yeah, it was their king who died. It's not surprising that the whole, okay, we have peace now, that's not the Zandalari, like, yo, we joined you to get revenge. You didn't provide even a smidgen of revenge. Like, you, not even a, you brought the Alliance to your capital's gates and fought with them. That's not revenge. I don't know if you, I thought you guys were down on revenge. I thought you had a pretty good grasp of revenge. Somebody kills your dad, you don't immediately work with them. That's a problem for me. So I thought that was interesting that they actually successfully jumped on that, and that's part of the story going forward. That was something I was interested to see. But yeah, without spoiling, there's lots of other stuff in this. The stuff that we've seen in the preview and the stuff we've seen in the teaser stuff definitely looks interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. I've not actually read anything by Madeline Rue before, but I'm interested.
I believe she did the Traveler series of books, right?
Yes, I believe you are correct.
Yeah, I'm excited to see her take on this. I'm excited to see how she crafts this part of the story. In this, like, everybody loves Christy Golden for very good reasons, but I'm interested to see somebody else take these characters that we know Christy has poured so much love and attention into and see what they do with it, especially with somebody like Madeline, who takes care and attention and is just a really cool person. So
some of the better novels, I mean, this is nothing against Christy, but we all know I love Christy. War Games is one of my favorite books, but the Illidan book that came out before Legion was really well done.
Yes.
And it wasn't, Christy didn't write that. I want to say Tom King, but I don't remember if that's his name or not. But yeah, the Illidan book was really good. So yeah, I'm excited. William King. See, Tom King is the guy who's been writing Batman, and I have thoughts about that, but we'll talk about that at some other podcast. Okay. So next thing we're going to talk about really fast is that for the first time in 8 years, somebody other than Method did a Mythic Boss world first.
Yeah, congrats to Limit.
I don't know if it was, I think someone other than Method may have done it before, but usually it was another European guild. This is the first time in 8 years that a North American guild has actually managed to kill a world first boss.
Since Empress, right?
Yeah, it's been 8 years. So, yeah. You know, congrats to Limit. It's an amazing thing to have done. The fight was, it wasn't like a Kill Jaden fight where they had literally thousands of pulls on it. They did get it done in a few hundred. A few hundred pulls is still a lot of pulls, guys. Don't go making it sound like this was easy. And Limit had to ride the razor's edge of hotfixes and adjustments while they were trying to do this fight. I was very impressed that they got it done. And it's weird because this wasn't one of my real big Mythic watching races. I wasn't as invested as I was in Legion. But when they finally started getting down to 2.5%, 2.3%, I started watching because, yeah, I'm going to watch that. What did you think about all of it? What did you think about all of the stuff that's been going on around this whole thing?
I'm not happy with some of the saltiness I've been seeing regarding all of this. Not just between certain people from Method not exactly being the nicest, not just to other folks in Limit, but also people that run websites like Warcraft logs and stuff like that. Like, I understand that they didn't get their world first, but it's the first time in 8 years. Like, y'all can chill a little bit. Like, it's a game. You didn't get first place. Okay, cool. Other than that, the other stuff I'm cool with, the weird comps that everybody ran, the weird or different ways that they were dealing with the bugs and the mechanics was absolutely phenomenal. And it actually, this is one of the first times that I watched a race as well. I haven't watched any of the world first races up until now. and it gave us, or gave, I don't want to say me, but like my guild ideas on how to handle certain things in normal and heroic that we probably wouldn't have considered because we're just not at that level. So
isn't like messed up? Like coming up from, you know, when we started playing, nobody did this.
Yeah.
It was like anathema, the idea that you'd let other guilds see your strats. Like, no.
Oh, yeah.
Nobody did that.
Back on Zul'jin in Classic WoW, because I was in a server-first guild, because that's what it was at the time, not world-first. Like, we would, like, change our gear so that Armory wouldn't show what we had. We would, you know, keep our forms locked down. We would IP restrict things so people couldn't see strategies. We would make sure our audio, like our voice chat was like locked all the way down so nobody that wasn't in the guild or didn't have the password could join in. And like it was crazy how guarded we were.
And now we live in a world where like guilds pushing world first will literally let you watch absolutely everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that is mind blowing to me. It's in a way it's ridiculously cool, but it's also totally like antithetical to how I think about raiding. So yeah, I've had to like make myself think differently, if it makes any sense. I've had to like get with what's going on, so to speak, if I don't want to sound too old. But yeah. So yeah, that happened. Congrats to Limit. I think quite frankly, Method being second in the world is not a bad thing. You've been first so many times, it'll give you a chance to take a nap. And then you'll come back and you'll dominate the next 12 raids. So, yeah, good for everybody. Last up for top stories, this one's a little different because I wrote an article just kind of on the fly talking about corruption for undergeared characters like your alts. And the reason I did that was because it's different when you're going into the expansion on your main and your main has already been raiding for a while. They've already done a bunch of you know, Eternal Palace stuff. They've got gear from Mythic dungeons and so forth. You're already pushing like 420, 430 before you even step into the new patch. But now you're getting on your alt who's like in 350, 360 gear. You haven't been playing them in a while. Maybe you just came back to WoW. Maybe you just haven't played this character in a while. And one of the things that can end up happening is because the world quest gear is capable of being corrupted, and because you're getting gear from the old god assaults that can range between 420 to 440, you can end up getting your gear going way up an item level really fast.
Oh yeah.
But it can be corrupted gear. And there's a thing where you don't really think about it too much because it's just dropping so quickly and it's all like, I'm going to use my paladin as an example because my paladin came in with like 380 gear on. And then I was like, okay, now I'm going to have, you know, 420, 430 gear dropping. And I put a bunch of it on and it didn't even occur to me that my corruption was like 120. And I hadn't even finished the opening quest yet. I didn't have my cloak yet. I didn't have any of the essences that reduce corruption. So I had 200 corruption and absolutely nothing to reduce it. So I went out and started doing the next assault and I got like, I literally got two pulls in and suddenly everything went off at once and I died horribly like a chicken.
Yep.
And that kept happening because it hadn't occurred to me just how high 200 corruption was. My main had 50 corruption and was dealing with it just fine, but my main didn't bother using much corrupted gear. There wasn't a reason to. The weapon upgrade was the only thing that was an absolute keeper. So I wrote a thing for the site about it. You can go to Blizzard Watch. It's still on the site. But basically, the thing I learned is that if you are on a character who is like undergeared, who is like maybe your item level is like at 420, 425 after you get the cloak, get your corruption down to below 30. You want, at the most, you want one or two corrupted things to be happening. I think at that item level, the most you want is maybe the eyeball spawning over your head and the thing from beyond chasing after you. And you don't want them at high levels. 30 to 35, I would say, is the highest you want it to do. And in fact, if you have enough corruption resistance to knock it down below 30, you should absolutely use it. Get the essence that has corruption resist on it so that you're getting 10 corruption resistance from your necklace. Get your cloak and do horrific visions to get your cloak boosted. Because if you can get it below 20, a below 20 corruption, you don't have any problems at all.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is happening. And you may be thinking, wow, that's really low. I'm not going to have any real corrupted gear. That's okay for your alt. If their gear item level is not high enough, they're not going to survive a lot of corruption stuff happening. It's going to end up killing you. And this is conservative. I freely admit it. And I'm going to turn it over to Joe now and see what he thinks, what his strategies are for dealing with corruption. I don't know how his alt situation is, but Joe, what do you think?
I have none of my alts because they can't deal with it. So literally anything I get, if I have enough mementos, I just go and purge it. And that's the end of the story for my alts. Like, they're never going to be at a place where I feel confident that they can handle anything above maybe possibly being slowed randomly. On my main, even, I won't use a lot of it, but also because I heal. In a lot of the corruption effects that, like, from the gear that's from questing or anything like that, aren't good for healers. Almost all of it is DPS specific. So I don't use it. Like, I want to. I want to have cool effects and stuff like that because I like the concept of it. But, like, I get more mastery. Well, 150% mastery really doesn't do me any good. I mean, not really. I can have some extra crit. Well, it's an extra 3%. Okay, it's good. It's not great. You know, it's not like Echoing Void, which has to be nerfed or adjusted because it's not doing exactly what they want. But, like, it's a cool effect when it visually triggers. The other problem I'd had is until last night, I couldn't stare at corruption at all. So for whatever reason, there's a light effect that's used in the purples and the reds for very high corruption, because you can see other players' corruption, that was giving me instant migraines. And there are spell effects towards the end of Nyalotha that have the exact same color light pattern as that corruption effect, and was doing the same thing. So I personally wasn't running a lot of corruption because I couldn't deal with it. There's no way to turn it off. There's no way to turn the visual off. So I just wouldn't equip corruption gear. But last night I figured for anybody out there that's having a similar problem to me, because I know I tweeted this out and I got a bunch of responses. Colorblind mode, the first one down, I can't remember the name of it. It's like protopania or something like that. Fixed it for me. It takes the color down just enough and mutes the light just enough. No more headaches. So now I can actually start looking at corruption gear again, maybe with a little more, a little less hesitation than I had before, because now I can actually play the game without having a splitting headache. So I'm cool. That's where I'm at with that.
All right. So yeah, there's ways to deal with it. Don't feel like you're being overwhelmed by it if you've been away from the game for a while, or if you're trying to juggle in on alts who don't have the same, you know, options as your main. There definitely are ways to deal with it. But at this point, I think we should probably move on to doing some emails.
I agree.
If you're prepared to read some, Joe.
And let us go forth.
Well, let me go ahead and do that thing where I tell people where to send us emails. Otherwise, it's just me talking. That's weird. If you have an email for the show, please send it to podcast@blizzardwatch.com with the subject line podcast or Blizzard Watch, so we know it's for this show and not for Lore Watch, because, you know, Lore Watch, we have a separate mailbag for them. If you don't mind, Joe, go ahead. Take it away.
Greetings, Watchers. I happened to rewatch the intro cinematic for Cataclysm the other day, and I became confused on the path of Deathwing. It shows him flying out of some mountain area to flying across the harbor of Aberdeen, and then finally landing on the gates of Stormwind. Is the cinematic correct? Does Deathwing burst out of some mountains, then do a globetrot destroying different places, then finally landing on Stormwind gates? How did the emergence of Deathwing manage to do so much damage to the world, while other events, such as the Legion's invasion or Nazoth's invasion, only affect small areas? Thank you for helping me understand this. Osserdug, Orc Warrior from Dalaran.
Well, up front, he bursts out of the maelstrom. Like, the, you know, if you have the Shaman class order hall in Legion, that place is where he comes out of. The rocks you see are him actually coming out of that area. And the reason it does so much damage is because he's traveling from another plane of existence to this one. He actually punches a hole in the matrices between the elemental plane of Earth, essentially, and Azeroth. The deep home is where he comes out of. And in so doing, he damages the titanic equipment that stabilized those dimensions. and thus they were crashing into Azeroth. Like, if you go to Uldum, the Vortex Pinnacle and Throne of the Four Winds, those aren't supposed to be there. Those are only there because Deathwing's going through Deepholm destroyed the pillar that was holding Deepholm up.
Yep.
And holding it up in a metaphysical sense. It was keeping it separate from Azeroth. With that damaged, the separation between the four elemental planes and Azeroth was also damaged, and so you were seeing the effects of the elements going bonkers. And we saw that in the elemental uprest before Cataclysm came out. The elementals knew something was going to happen. They could feel it. They understood that that bad things were coming, and it had them, you know, for one thing, both Ragnaros and I'm forgetting who the other one. I think it was actually Alakir. They were working with Deathwing. So the elementals knew because the top elementals were straight up signed on board. And so they started freaking out. In terms of his flight path, it does seem weird to me, it always has, that he flew out of the Maelstrom, took a ride all the way over to Kalimdor, wiped out Aberdeen, and then flew back towards the Eastern Kingdoms to take out the dam before hitting Stormwind. But it's not that surprising that he might have been wheeling around when he comes out of Deepholm. Keep in mind, the amount of power it took to punch a hole between Deepholm and Azeroth is pretty extreme. It's not surprising that it took him a while to get control of his flight. And it's even more horrific when you realize he may have destroyed Aberdeen kind of accidentally. Like, he wasn't really trying to destroy Aberdeen, it just happened. It was just in his way, and he didn't care. Whereas he deliberately went for Stormwind because he wanted to get his kids' bodies back. Their heads were currently hanging from the city gates, and he didn't like that. He wanted to get them back. That's exactly how we get Onyxia and Nefarian back in this expansion, is because Deathwing was going to Stormwind to get their corpses.
Mm-hmm.
So, I guess canonically, that's where they ended up. But yeah, I think that's pretty much it. Like, that's what happened. I mean, do you think of anything?
The only other thing I can think of is, like, it was called the Madness of Deathwing for a reason. It's also entirely possible that he broke out and, you know, took a while to get control of himself. Maybe not necessarily his flight. He could have been sort of in a frenzied state and not really thinking about where he was going and just kind of flying around. He was a gigantic dragon, big enough that we were fighting on his back at one point. Like,
yeah, if you remember the little speech he gives during the cinematic, he's not doing well mentally.
No, he is not. Like,
he's hurting. And you even see them if you watch the cinematic. By the way, the cinematic's amazing. They're nailing giant elementium plates to his back. And, you know, they're driving them in with enormous spikes that they have to use enormous hammers on swing sets to smash into him. They're like using battering rams to hammer this armor into his body. He probably wasn't feeling too great. He's probably pretty upset. That's what I'm going with.
Yeah, and that would be my guess, is more he just wasn't in complete control of his mental faculties quite yet. And even then, he never really got full control. But he wasn't quite 100% Deathwing, and that's probably why he was all over the place. Until he got control of himself, was like, okay, well, I can feel where my kids' bodies are. I'm going to go get them back. All right, Stormwind, I'm on my way. Let's go, you know, deal with that. So that's my guess.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Next up. Hi, guys. A few episodes ago, you spoke about having different flavor for gear and WoW. What do you think of bringing D3-style legendary traits that change up the way abilities passives work to completely change the way a specific spec plays? It could be done in any number of ways, like tier bonuses, individual legendaries, etc. Imagine having 2 to 3 pieces of gear with certain mods that change a prop warrior to DPS at the cost of threat and defense stats so that you become a viable DPS. Just something I thought of that has the potential of some of that flavor we're all looking for. I hope this blows up into an hour-long conversation that gets people thinking. Keep up the good work. And this is from Durgis, Torn Druid on Silver Moon.
You know what would really be interesting about these legendaries? What if when they, you know, there was a bunch of them for different specs and stuff, and you could buy them using items that you got during dungeons and so forth, and your reputation as you went on, you could buy the ones you didn't already get. And we could call it World of Warcraft Legion, because that's what they did with legendaries in Legion, man. Remember that? That's what they were doing. They maybe didn't go as far as to let your prot warrior go DPS, but they did that in Warlords of Draenor with Gladiator Stance. That was an actual talent that you could take. So they have done those things. I don't think the Legion, I don't think that the Diablo model works all that great in World of Warcraft. And I think it doesn't work that great in World of Warcraft because World of Warcraft is kind of afraid to go whole hog with it because of all the balance. I mean,
yeah, I think that's the big thing, the balance, right?
In Diablo, if like a Barb is just not as good as a Crusader, it doesn't really matter as much because you probably won't just switch to Crusader. You'll probably just stick it out with your Barbarian. For a lot of reasons, including that, you know, you'd have to gear them up all over again and so forth. And the more time you have invested in Diablo, the more unlikely you are to switch away from your characters that you play a lot. And there's less abilities. Like Diablo, you have more options on abilities, but you have with most, what, six buttons you're pushing? Whereas, you know, the action bar in World of Warcraft, even after the ability pruning, is just crazy long. I've got like a ton of buttons here, looking at my character UI right now. Just so many. Some of them are doubled up, obviously. I'm not using absolutely all of those buttons, but I have a lot of them.
So here's what I think about it. I think Legion did do this to a certain degree. It didn't really completely change, like, playstyles for the legendaries. Like, it didn't change how I was a resto shaman. I was still a resto shaman. I just had
It did for some classes. Some of them did.
Yeah.
Like, I think it was Death Knights, for instance. I had Unholy Death Knights completely changed how they worked.
The thing that I will say is, while I like this idea, I think this comes to a fundamental difference between an MMO and an ARPG. Now, an ARPG, while you can play with other players, like, you look at games like Torchlight, Diablo, Pillars of Eternity, all that stuff, they don't have to worry about balance in the same way as World of Warcraft does. Specifically, and then I'll bring up PvP here. How many things have we had balanced, adjusted, or moved around in-game over the course of 15 years because it completely broke player versus player? I can tell you quite a bit because it needed to be maintained. Like, you would see at one point, we talked about this during the pre-show a little bit, you would see entire teams of, like, you know, enhancement shamans with Wind Fury and Hand of Ragnaros that would just blow up groups because it was unbalanced. You would have different healers that could completely outclass other healers in PvP because it was unbalanced. And they spent a lot of time.
Yeah, the only thing that kept warriors viable in PvP for years was Mortal Strike.
Yep.
It wasn't how much damage they could do, although they could do some damage. They could actually hurt people. But it was that big Mortal Strike because it would reduce healing by half.
Yep, it was massive.
Yeah, and there wasn't a healer in the game who didn't hate it. And warriors were nerfed so many times because of it. But it kept warriors viable forever. And because it kept warriors viable forever, the other two specs that didn't have it were never viable.
Yep.
Fury was never viable in PvP for years.
Now, I know that the counter argument to that by somebody is like, well, then gives a legendary that gives that, you know, Mortal Strike those other two specs. Yes, but then how do you balance the rest of that class spec against that, right? Because when you look at the classes, you look at the specs, you look at the individual kits that were given, they're balanced amongst themselves, not just the rest of the classes and specs. And stuff like this, while it's a really cool idea, and I really like the idea of having something that changes passes or abilities in those ways to make classes feel completely different, I don't think it would be a good player experience in the end. Not necessarily just because of you. Like, if you don't have any legendaries, but you're going against a mage, and that mage has something completely out of left field that you have no idea how to handle because they have one specific legendary.
He's got that legendary that gives him the ability to put Ice Block on you.
Yeah, how do you deal with that?
Now Ice Block is a CC that you can't get out of. And it's, you know, sure, you're immune to damage. Meanwhile, you're utterly helpless and your entire party is being destroyed. You ice block the healer. Well, that's over. You know, that there's some ideas that's really cool. Oh, wow. That would really suck to have that happen to you.
But that's why I'm a real big proponent of, like, visual changes and visual flavor versus mechanical flavor, if that makes sense. So, like, I'd rather see the spell effect change or a character wear something different or thematically be different but have the same effects. Like, you can have a bear totem warrior that works just like a prot warrior, but just looks different. Like, that's the type of stuff that I talk about with flavor, because that doesn't change the balance. That just changed the user, the individual user experience, in a way that's meaningful to that person, but doesn't break the game. At least.
And yeah, and part of the problem is this game's balancing system is
archaic.
I mean, yeah, the original game is from, you know, 2004. And sure, it's been changed a lot since, but at the heart of it, we have the three roles, and the three roles still define World of Warcraft in a very fundamental way. You have tank, DPS, and healer. And there's a reason there's almost, like, they've never added a pure DPS class. They've only ever added a tanking class or a tank heal class, which is, you know, they've only added hybrids from the beginning. Every class added has been a hybrid. It's yep. Death Knights, tank and DPS. Monks, tank, DPS, and heal. Demon Hunters, tank and DPS. They're never going to add a class that doesn't have two roles. Because of how well controlled this game is by those roles. Even in stuff like PvP. Even there, those roles really do define it. And maybe that's archaic, maybe that's old, but it is so built into the DNA of the game that even when an entirely new talent system came along, that talent system still enshrined it.
Yep. And to put it in perspective, and this is to go back to something that Matt and I, we talk about a lot, and it's something we love a lot. Let's talk about D&D in this regard too. Because for generations and generations and generations, this holy trinity of healer, DPS, tank was what D&D was, until they basically blew it up with 4th edition and started really pushing the boundaries of what you could do with group composition. Love or hate 4th edition, doesn't matter. That was the complete and utter blowing up of essentially those roles and trying to reshuffle it. And now we have 5th edition, which I've had player groups that don't have a dedicated healer, and they're fine. I have groups that don't have a dedicated tank, and they're fine. Because you can build your characters, the game system is balanced in such a way now that you can do that when it wasn't before. And that's the same sort of thing we're walking into with an MMO. The big difference is being, with an MMO, it's programmed. There's not somebody sitting behind the wheel that can make an adjustment on the fly if something's not exactly right. Tabletop games, they can.
Plus, in a tabletop game, the most you have is you've got like 6-7 other players at that table. And that's all that really matters to you. You don't have the entire population of a realm
engaged in organized millions PvP. Of subscribers, yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, for example, what's the highest DPS melee class in D&D right now, you think?
From a pure standpoint, from the base ones, I think Rogue actually has the highest... pure DPS
barbarian
potential. Is it barbarian?
Barbarian, because the rogue is considered a utility.
Oh, fair enough.
They have very high DPS, but they're also a utility. But also, what's the tankiest class in D&D right now?
I would argue barbarian on that front too.
Barbarian, yep, especially certain builds like the zealot or bear.
Oh,
and yet that doesn't overshadow other classes,
mm-hmm.
because other classes can have abilities like a fighter's action surge. Or a paladin smiting that can let them compete in those arenas and yet have higher utility for other things. The barbarian's effectively a one-trick pony in comparison. And it's just like nobody's like, I've never been in a situation where anyone playing a rogue has said, yeah, now I'm going to quit reroll barbarian because I want more damage. Maybe the barbarian does more damage on a few hits, but who cares? There's so many other reasons to play a rogue: stealth, high skills, stuff that the MMO just isn't going to have. It's balanced entirely mechanically.
Yep,
and D&D is not balanced that way.
And I think that's the root of the problem. You have to keep in mind at the end of the day that you're dealing with mechanical systems that have been in place for ages. And so anything that changes how a fundamental class works or potentially does, that's potentially problematic and destabilizing. Now, again, and I'll say this again, I like the idea of it. I just don't know of a way that you can currently do it in an MMO that isn't going to be completely breaking it.
Yeah. I'm going to go back to something I was talking about in the pre-show for a second here. and how Kingdoms of Amalur worked. Because Kingdoms of Amalur is an example of a system that was built to be role agnostic. Your character, since it was just you, it was a single player RPG, and if somebody else played it differently, what did you care? You were never going to see their game.
Yeah.
And because of that, it had a completely agnostic approach to the roles. You could be tanky, you could be a stealth DPSer, you could cast like fireballs at people. You could do these things, and it didn't matter if you had I have both fireballs and a two-handed sword. Those things didn't matter because the other person who didn't have them didn't care. There was no feeling of like unbalance. There was no, well, this one will always win in these situations because they weren't fighting, and they weren't like, you didn't have to look at like, okay, we've got like 500 groups raiding this instance, and there are no shamans in any of those groups. Why? Why is nobody playing the shaman? Oh, it turns out the shaman is like, just doesn't have the tools to heal this. Okay, next tier. Now suddenly we have a ton of shaman. Well, mm-hmm. It turns out that the shaman have great tools for healing this, and paladins can't stack up. That's the kind of thing that's effective, that affects people playing the game, that won't affect people in other kinds of games. Now, saying that, I loved Gladiator Stance.
Oh yeah, it was great.
I thought it was great. It was a lot of fun. It was really interesting and challenging. The DPS always sucked. It was good. It was good for one half of one tier of rating. Like, there were prop pallies using Gladiator Stance who did okay DPS in high maul. And then once gear caught up, they suddenly weren't good anymore.
But that's another great example of balance, right? Because it was so hard to balance. That's why it's not there anymore.
Exactly. It was. Then that's the thing where if we start adding in stuff that does like Gladiator Stance does and completely changes the way a spec works, like, yes, if your Death Knight takes these various legendaries, it will change their unholy spec to one that uses daggers and can do tons of magic damage at range. That's cool, but is it going to be balanced against all the people we already have who use daggers and do spells at range? No, probably not. It'll probably be inferior to them. But that's the price you pay for getting to do it on a character that's not supposed to be able to do it. Then why am I doing it? And that's always the problem with an MMO that you don't have other games. So I don't know. At the end of the day, my Diablo characters are usually, they're barbarians because I like playing barbarians, and the fact that Crusaders are better at greater rifts doesn't really affect me. Although I do play a Crusader from time to time. But you know, see what I'm saying? It's not the same as in WoW, where it's like you're trying to get a dungeon group, and I'm looking back to like the days of the Burning Crusade here, when a warrior tank was trying to get a dungeon group and they couldn't because everybody wanted to not use any CC. They wanted the paladin and druid AoE threat generation that warriors did not have. And then we got into raids and suddenly nobody wanted paladins and druids because warriors had the tools to push all of the boss damage away that the other classes didn't have. In both of those cases, it needed rebalancing. And that's something that once you start adding in items that completely change a spec, you're going to need even more balancing.
Yep. And that's not to say that we don't like the idea of it or anything like that. We don't want to crash the idea completely. And if you have ideas that you have out there, and this is for all of you listeners, of stuff that you'd like to see in this vein that you think wouldn't be completely breaking the game, let us know. I'd love to hear some of your ideas out there.
You know, for that matter, I'd love to see them and give this another shot. I'd love to see Gladiators like come back. I'd love to see them bring in just something like a set of gear or an ability, like a talent that would let shaman tank again.
I would lose my mind with happiness.
I used to tank on a shaman.
So did
I tanked Karazhan on a shaman.
So did I. My co-tank was a boomkin.
Yeah. My co-tank was a warlock. But yeah, you back in BC, you could tank effectively on a shaman. Because you could get the PvP gear at the time had resilience.
Yep.
I don't know if you guys remember resilience. Oh, been a while. But resilience, essentially, it functioned like defense to a degree because it
lowered income defense and damage.
Not just lowering income and damage. It pushed crits away.
Yes.
And crits were the big problem. You could reach uncrittable on a character with full resilience gear. So on my shaman, who did mostly PvP, I brought him in and tanked Karazhan on him, and up till we got to I don't remember the last boss's name.
In Karazhan?
The one who dropped all those fire dudes on the raid.
Prince Malcazar.
Old Dimensions. Yeah, Prince Malcazar. He was the only one I couldn't tank. Just because it was just so much damage. And we didn't have a healer who could handle it. But other than that, yeah, I tanked the whole thing. And it worked fine. I'd love to see stuff like that. I just feel like you got to temper your expectations with the fact that maybe they could do it, but they'd have to not do other things. And they're never going to be... No one's ever going to find the magic thing that everyone can have what they want and everybody gets the development they want. That's just never going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, again, we'll see, but let us know your ideas. Moving on, we have... Hello, all. I've asked y'all some hard questions lately, so I decided to come with easy ones. One, I recall leveling in Pandaria after Mop had a veil that was wrecked by Garrosh. You mentioned on the last show that you believe leveling in Mop in 9.0 will have the old veil. Did you mean the one with the scar, or the original veil, or the restored veil? These are from Shad. I think we can do them one at a time.
Yeah, I meant the one before Garrosh blew it up, so same. The original veil.
Yeah, that's what I meant too. Like, as you go through the expansion, you're going to experience it like we did when we first went through the expansion. So the veil will be in one piece until it isn't. And after we move past it, then we'll get to the restored portion. But I think it will actually follow the phases that it did originally. That's what I meant by that. Second part of the question, theoretical. If Blizzard could go back in time and you choose how far back and make a change to WoW, what would it be and why? I personally wonder if they wish they had started the level by expansion sooner. Well, you have first crack at this one.
There wouldn't be any warriors.
Okay.
I love warriors, you know I do, but I don't think the warrior class has enough of an identity. And Blizzard has never really known how to make it have an identity other than guys who hit things. The warrior class hall in particular, when we got it, I kept saying to myself, compare this to the Death Knight one, or the Paladin one, or the Shaman one, or the Mage one, or the Hunter one. Those all have an identity. This is, I'm a Pokemon for a big yelly guy with a beard on fire. He, who is this dude to me? I've never seen him before. I never heard, I vaguely know he's one of the Watchers from Alduar. That's it. And there's no cool lore figures here at all. That's when I said, you know what they needed was an Alliance specific class and a Horde specific class that do the same thing. Instead of having Paladins and Shaman be faction restricted, I would have them both be from the start in both factions, and I'd have there be like the Berserker over on the Horde and the Knight over on the Warrior, and functionally they'd be the same, but they'd be different in flavor.
Yeah, and I think
where the Horde is the Horde Blademaster is the arms for Horde side, the Horde Berserker, it's just literally just a crazy guy with two axes screaming. That's most orcs, so you'd have that. And you'd have like the Tauren tradition would be where they got their tanks from. And for the Alliance ones, you'd have like a Night Elf kind of stealth assassin is their Fury Warrior. You'd have the Knight as their Arms Warrior, and you'd have the Mountain King as their Prop Warrior. And they would be tied into their origins and their roles in the franchise. And they'd all have the same basic abilities, but they'd be different in flavor, and you wouldn't consider them the same. Like a Horde Grunt and a Alliance Footman aren't the same.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I think part of the original identity for warriors kind of got lost in the shuffle, because back during Classic, I think they were always intended to be like the Weapon Masters, and it never really happened.
It didn't.
Especially once Burning Crusade hit and we all started getting access to more weapons. Because I remember back in the day, on a Shaman, I could use a mace and a staff and fist weapons, and that was it. Like, and then they opened it up. Yep. And they changed it mm-hmm. later, and that took away some of that specialization from warriors in general. Right,
the Death Knight came along and it really was like a nail to warriors having yeah. a unique identity.
I remember not seeing a warrior for warrior that entire expansion.
Yeah, I was the only one I knew. I stuck with them, but nobody else did. I remember being the standard bearer for the class at a time where absolutely everybody wanted to go Death Knight.
Yep.
Because Blizzard's idea was warriors were always like, let us tank with two-handed weapons. Blizzard's like, wow, tanking with two-handed weapons sounds great. Here's a class that does it. And we were like, that was what we wanted. That was our thing. You just gave our thing to them.
Yeah.
And look at Warlocks with, like, you know, let us tank in demon form. Tanking in demon form, that sounds like a great idea. Here's demon hunters. And Warlocks are like, what? Okay, we're going to have to take that thing where you turn into a demon. We're going to take it away from you because we're giving it to them. What?
No.
No. Our thing.
I will say, for me, going back in time, I want to take it all the way back to before the game ever released, when they were still on the drawing boards. And this is something I talked about many, many, many years ago, and I still hold in my heart of hearts, we don't have true hybrids. There has only been one game that I know of that has ever done hybrids truly well, and I really wish it would have been World of Warcraft. Back during the days of Lord of the Rings Online, the Rune Priest was it remains the only class I know that is a pure hybrid between DPS and healing. Your choices affect how well you do each of them without changing spec. It's just how the kit is built. And it was phenomenal. And I would love to have seen a discussion back before the game ever released, when they started to talk about hybrids, because even back then they talked about hybrid classes, like, oh, you can do this and this. And that's the way the talent trees were set up, is that you could dip so far into each. I would have liked to have seen them take those ideas and expand them to make hybrids really a thing, because I think it is a very cool style of play that nobody does. And it's almost impossible to find if you're not in, like, an ARPG or something like that. But I think can work and can be balanced in context of an MMO, in a raid group, in a party system, all of that stuff. That's what I would have loved to see. Give me something where, you know, my healing power is proportional to, you know, the amount of healing I've done, you know, up to this point, or my damage versus, like, reverse of that or whatever. That's what I would have loved to have seen. A pure, true hybrid class concept from the very beginning. So, anything else to add on that one?
No, I think we're pretty much done.
All right. We're coming up close to time. Do we want to do another question, or do we want to call it?
Yeah, absolutely. Why not?
All right. Greetings, Watchers. I've enjoyed the new Lunar Festival quest that grant permanent transmog capabilities for the Flower Crowns. It's the first time in a decade I've participated in the holidays since achieving what a long, strange trip it's been. I know some of them, including Lunar Festival, have had new stuff added over the years, but I liked the way these presented, with having to bounce all over the world to acquire the crowns and then convert them to everlasting. Would you like to see more of it in the future? We'll know soon if they add something similar for Love is in the Air, but it got me thinking. If you could pick one or two more holiday-only cosmetic items for them to make permanently available in the wardrobe, what would you pick? Assuming they don't just do something for all of them this year in the calendar order, I guess. Thanks, Marilyn from Stormrange.
I'm going to be embarrassed here, but I'll just admit this. As much as I'm a big transmog fan, I've never paid attention to the holiday only items, because they don't interest me because they're holiday only items. So I just put them out of my head. Like, I don't look at them. I don't pay any attention to them.
That's fair.
So I can't really, there's nothing I can think of that's a holiday only item that I would want to transmog to. Like, the flower crown doesn't even interest me. So yeah,
I've got one. I mean,
go for it.
You do sunglasses. Any of the sunglasses that are in game, please, Blizzard, for the love of everything, let me transmog into them all year round. They're absolutely amazing, and they look goofy as heck on my Torn, and I love them. I love them so much. Whether it's the gold ones or the ones from Love is in the Air, just let me, give me a quest that lets me transmog into them all year round. They're so awesome. They're like the only holiday-specific cosmetic item in this game, whether it's the anniversary, Love is in the Air, or any of that stuff, that I love. And I would fight for that. Come on, let us do that. And I know I'm not the only one, because I know that I've had people comment the exact same thing to me. And just at this point, just let us do it, man. Come on, please. Yeah, sunglasses. Yeah.
In general, I'm in favor of them loosening any and all transmog restrictions, but that's one that just never really occurred to me. I've never really thought about it, because I just don't do holiday stuff that much.
It's fair enough. But that takes us through all of our questions. Thank you, everybody who sent stuff in. Again, please continue to send it to us. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch. Your continued support means this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your questions answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. Anything you want to add?
I was going to say, if you have an email for the show, again, please send it to podcast@blizzardwatch.com with the subject line podcast of Blizzard Watch so we know it's for this show. Thank you guys so much for sending in the ones you did, because, you know, that's how we do shows. Don't really have any emails. We just stand around looking at each other for a while. And since we're not in the same room and don't have cameras, we kind of have to guess where the other person would be. And it's just weird and awkward. So thanks for not making us have to do that. You know, again, this has been the Blizzard Watch podcast. Y'all, dang it. I went y'all at the end. Why does this happen? I'm from New England. My grandmother was actually from Texas, so it's probably that. But yeah, anyway, thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll be here next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.